Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown podcast. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for DebtWire Municipals. Joining me today are Paul Gunther, legal analyst for DebtWire, and head of research for DebtWire Munis, Greg Clark. Welcome to the podcast, Paul and Greg.
Hey, Paul. And Paul. How come Paul Gunther got top billing ahead of me?
He's a guest. So guests right. Get preferred billing.
Fair enough.
Hi, Paul.
So the podcast title for today's episode is Chester, Pennsylvania's Chapter 9 Clash. And we'll be discussing the bankruptcy filing that Chester did back in November of 2022. So, Greg, when I think about Chapter 9 filing, the main thought that comes to my mind is incremental credit deterioration as the city's decline has progressed over many decades. And can you provide context for how we got into this current situation? And Greg, I also want to say, and for the audience, 4 decades of experience in the Muni analyst world. You don't look a day over 25, maybe 35.
That's true.
But you're here because of all your expertise and you've seen many different situations over time. So can you explain a little bit about Chester in the context in terms of how do we get here?
Sure, Paul. Thank you. Chester is perhaps a textbook example of a Northeast city that once had a strong economic base that extended through World War II, but then started to decline. It's the oldest city in Pennsylvania, first settled in the mid-1600s. Over time, its industries included oil refining, metal manufacturing, locomotives and shipbuilding, and textiles. Its biggest growth spurt occurred around the time of World War I, with the second period of growth during World War II. Its decline started after World War II, as seen in the city's population loss down to 32,500 in 2021 from 66,000 in 1950. So that's about 50% over a 45-year period. Chester's location had a lot to do with its success. It's located in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware tri-state area, about 18 miles southwest of Philadelphia, 15 miles northeast of Wilmington, but perhaps most important to its development was its location on the Delaware River. Chester seems to me like, if you're from that area, you've heard of Chester like for a long time. I had never heard of it until it started to have financial problems and state oversight and all that. But again, that's probably I'm guessing that if you're from that area, you know about Chester, and especially for some of the reasons that you'll hear about in a minute. For instance, Chester is known for political corruption, for having had the strongest political machine in Pennsylvania history. I have to say that's quite a statement. The political machine was run by a Republican political boss named John McClure, who ruled the city from 1907 until 1965. Despite being convicted in 1933 for bootlegging, the city was also known as a haven for all types of vice and also has a history of racial strife and organized crime activity. McClure was such a power in that area that Richard Nixon, during his 1960 campaign for president, made a special stop to stop in to see John McClure when he was in Pennsylvania campaigning. So that tells you something. Okay, now into more mundane matters, and Paul Gunther will get into this a little bit more, but just to set the stage a touch, in April 1995, Chester was designated as a distressed municipality under state law. It maintained that status until April of 2020, when then-Governor Tom Wolf declared a fiscal emergency for the city due to its financial situation and effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. And then in June 2020, the state appointed a receiver for the city who has many of the rights and authority to manage city operations normally reserved for elected officials. The biggest effect of COVID-19 on the city was closure of a Harrah's casino and racetrack that provided significant revenue, $11.5 million in fiscal year 18 to the city. Casino revenues were thus equal to about 25% of that year's general fund revenues. As is common with many distressed borrowers, Chester's market disclosure is weak. The most recent audit posted on EMMA, Electronic Municipal Market Access, is for fiscal year 18, which ended December 31st of that year. The audit letter is dated May 26th of 2021 and contains going concern language regarding the city.
Greg, let me jump in right there. So today we're recording this podcast on May 10th, 2023.
Yes.
And you're telling me that the last time the city had an audit that was done and went through the whole process and was certified was in December of 2018 was the Correct. Last audit?
Right.
Okay.
And the audit was not released until 2 years ago. So there's about 2.5 years between end of the fiscal year and release of the audit for that fiscal year. And also 2 years since another audit has come out. Obviously, they should come out every year. So like I said, it reminds you of other distressed borrowers. One that comes to mind first is Puerto Rico, which, as many of our listeners will know, has been way behind on its audits for, I don't know how long, decades maybe. Some other details about fiscal year 18. In that year, the general fund deficit was $21 million, and its general fund revenues that year were $46 million. So, you know, somewhat less than half, but pretty close to half. At the close of fiscal year 18, the city had $3.25 million tax and revenue anticipation notes, also known as TRANS, outstanding, and $23 million of long-term debt. Its pensions were only 30% funded at the end of fiscal 18. The city has three of its own pension funds, one for police, one for firemen, and one for other employees. And there had been a default on 2016. I'm not sure when the default occurred, but there was a default on 2016's tax and revenue anticipation notes. Without a state loan of $5 million and federal COVID aid of $30 million, and actions taken by the city's receiver to reduce expenditures, the city probably would have run out of cash during 2021. On September 13 of last year, the receiver made a presentation to a state oversight board about the possible need to file for bankruptcy, and then on December 22nd, borrowed $5 million from the state in order to pay employees. So that's some of the bad news. Some bright spots for the city include the presence of Widener University, which has about 2,700 students, and Subaru Stadium, which was built in part with proceeds of bonds issued by Delaware County, Pennsylvania. The stadium is the home of the Philadelphia Union of Major League Soccer. And finally, regarding the city's status, as the chief of staff declared, with the exception of the city's potential right to monetize the assets of the Chester Water Authority, which is a subject of significant litigation, and the city's parking revenue potential, the city's assets are limited in number, suffer from years of deferred maintenance, and have little market value.
Greg, thanks. That was a lot to digest, but I thought it was important to give the proper context to the economic, financial, and political landscape we're dealing with in Chester. Paul, welcome to the podcast. You're a first-time participant. It is great to have you here to discuss some of the legal issues that Chester, Pennsylvania is facing. Just a little background on Paul. He's a former practicing restructuring and litigation attorney. Prior to joining DebtWire as a legal analyst, Paul practiced in the New York offices of several law firms in New York City and has represented various constituencies in high-profile restructurings. And there's an important disclaimer that I need to read now. Any opinion, analysis, or information provided in this podcast is not intended, nor should it be construed as legal advice, including but not limited to investment advice as defined by the Investment Company Act of 1940. DebtWire does not provide any legal advice, and subscribers should consult with their own legal counselor for matters requiring legal advice. So, need to get it out that way, Paul. Set the context properly. So, Greg has mentioned that the city is now being overseen by a receiver. The receiver's name is Michael Dovery. Can you explain the receivership process for us, Paul?
Sure, Paul, and thanks for having me. The procedures for appointing a receiver are set forth in the Pennsylvania Municipalities Financial Recovery Act of 1987, or Act 47, as it's more frequently called. And the act provides for the state oversight of and financial assistance to distressed municipalities. The act is administered by the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development, or just shorten it and we'll call it the DCED for the rest of this podcast. Other Pennsylvania municipalities that are operating under a distressed status include the state capital, Harrisburg, and Hazleton, whose exit from distress status was announced just last week. As Greg noted, in 1995, Chester was designated a distressed city under Act 47 and subjected to the Commonwealth's financial oversight. In April 2020, Governor Tom Wolf declared a fiscal emergency in Chester under Act 47. These kinds of declarations are made when a municipality is insolvent or projected to be insolvent within 180 days, or when it can't ensure the continued provision of vital and necessary services such as police, fire, ambulance, and rescue services, or if it can't fulfill payroll and pension obligations. In June 2020, the DCED nominated and the Commonwealth Court of Pennsylvania appointed Dowiri to serve as receiver with the power to propose and implement a recovery plan for the city. A recovery plan must provide for the continued provision of vital and necessary services and the payment of the city's obligations, including debt obligations, municipal securities, and pension fund payments. In addition, the recovery plan can provide for the sale or lease of the city's assets or the approval, modification, termination, or renegotiation of contracts to the extent that that's permissible under state and federal law. The receiver can also employ professionals to carry out those duties. Dowiri submitted an initial recovery plan in August 2020 and an amended recovery plan in April 2021. He reduced city expenditures and its workforce, instituted a hiring freeze, and limited discretionary spending. However, he said that further budget cuts alone would not make a dent in the city's pension obligations and in retiree health care costs. In January 22, he requested authorization to file a Chapter 9 case on behalf of the city. And in February 2022, the DCED secretary authorized him to do so. And the case was filed November 10th of last year.
What are the main issues that the city faces in bankruptcy? And what about the city's pension obligations?
The city faces several issues, but the most pressing one is how to address its pension and retiree health benefit obligations. As Greg noted, the city has three pension plans, one for the police, one for firemen, and an employees plan. Between 2013 and 2021, the city didn't even have enough cash to make the minimum municipal obligation or MMO contributions to the plans. The police pension plan, which is the worst off, was projected to have, as of December 31st of last year, only 13 months of benefit payments left. And that actually represented an improvement from 2020, when the city at one point had the funds for only 3 months worth of payments. The aggregate unpaid MMO as of December 31, 2020 was almost $40 million, $39.8 million, which represented a staggering 69% of the city's 2022 general fund budget. And to fully fund the pension plans, the city would need to pay another $87.4 million, which represents missing interest. The city's other post-employment benefit or OPEB obligations, which include retiree healthcare costs, cost $5.5 million annually, and that's more than the cost of healthcare for the city's active employees. Also, the total liability for the OPEB benefits is $232.9 million, and none of that is pre-funded. So given the size of those pension and OPEB obligations and considering the city's severely reduced tax base, it will be absolutely essential for the city to modify the pension obligations in Chapter 9.
Okay, Paul, but hold on a second. Usually or typically when we're talking about pensions as opposed to OPEBs, I was always under the impression that OPEBs were a bit more easier to modify than pensions because pensions had statutory protections. So how can they be modified?
Well, the pensions under Pennsylvania law, the retirement code statute and the pension obligations are considered binding contractual obligations of the state. However, the bankruptcy code gives debtors, including municipal debtors, the power to reject or modify contracts that they would otherwise be prohibited from impairing outside of a bankruptcy. The rejection of a contract in bankruptcy relieves the debtor from all further obligations. It's considered a breach of the agreement that gives rise to a claim for money damages. However, the damages aren't paid in full in bankruptcy, but they're paid pro rata as general unsecured claims. So we can expect that pensions are going to be targeted for cuts.
So what can pensioners do?
Pensioners can object to any proposed cuts and vote against any plan of adjustment that the city proposes. The plan could be approved over their objections. Chapter 9 plans of adjustment are similar to Chapter 11 plans of reorganization, and that they provide the roadmap and the contractual obligations for the restructuring. However, there's some important differences between Chapter 9 plans and Chapter 11 plans. In a Chapter 11 case, the bankruptcy court and the debtor can do what's called a cram down. In that case, the bankruptcy court can confirm a plan even if it's rejected by a class of creditors, so long as the plan is fair and equitable. That is, if at least one impaired class votes to confirm the plan, and no class junior to the rejecting class receives any recovery. That's called the absolute priority rule. However, in Chapter 9 cases, the fair and equitable requirement plays out somewhat differently. One court's even noted that in a Chapter 9 case, the fair and equitable requirement means that holders of claims receive all they can reasonably expect under the circumstances. In a Chapter 11 case, for example, equity can't receive any distribution if unsecured claims are impaired. However, in municipal bankruptcies, there's no junior equity class. The equity holder is effectively the city in its capacity as property owner. And courts have rejected the argument that a municipality cannot retain its property in Chapter 9, even though creditors aren't paid in full. So if the city proposes a plan of adjustment that impairs both secured bondholders and the pension holders, the bondholders vote in favor of the plan, it could cram down the pension holders and seek approval of the plan over their objection. However, it would prefer to avoid this result and achieve a consensual resolution.
So what have pensioners done thus far in this Chapter 9 case?
There have been two notable developments. First is the appointment, and upon the city's motion, of an official committee of retirees. That's important because it'll allow pensioners who individually wouldn't have the resources to mount a strong challenge to the city's proposals and plan to hire professionals that will be paid by the city. The committee is statutorily empowered to consult with the city about the case and the administration of the case, to investigate the city, including its financial condition, and to participate in the formulation of any plan. The second development is the referral of the pension and OPEB disputes to mediation, once again upon the city's motion. In the motion, the city states that the disputes to be mediated include the funding and adjustment of pensions, the OPEB benefits, and the negotiation of new collective bargaining agreements. With regard to the latter, the city's collective bargaining agreement with police officers expired at the end of 2021, and its agreement with non-uniformed employees would expire, or did expire, at the end of 2022. The city has stated that those contracts need to be renegotiated or rejected.
So we've talked about pensions and other retiree obligations, but I'm sure our listeners are interested in as well, what's going to happen with bondholders and how are bond obligations going to be handled, or what's the expectation for the city in terms of how they want that addressed in the bankruptcy?
There are several interesting issues there, but one thing to note too is that the bond obligations relative to the pension obligations are very small. And before going into specifically the bonds, I'd like to give a little background on how municipal bonds are treated in bankruptcy. Municipal bonds can generally be divided into two camps, general obligation or GO bonds and revenue bonds. GO bonds are backed by the full faith and credit of the government and can be paid from any revenue source, including taxes and securities. Revenue bonds, on the other hand, are secured and repaid from the dedicated revenues of a specific asset, such as, for example, highway tolls or water and sewage systems. Section 552A of the Bankruptcy Code provides that liens on pre-petition collateral arising from a pre-petition security agreement do not automatically attach to property acquired by the debtor after the filing of the bankruptcy case. Section 552B provides that liens do attach if the security agreement provides for attachment. In Chapter 9 cases, notwithstanding Section 552A, which again provides that liens on pre-petition property do not automatically attach to the debtor's after acquired property, Section 928 of the Bankruptcy Code provides that liens on special revenues automatically extend to after acquired property. Special revenues are dedicated revenues from a specific municipal asset, for example, receipts from the ownership, operation, or sale of city systems and projects, such as highway or sewage systems, as well as taxes used to finance those systems, but excluding general property sales or income taxes. In addition, the automatic stay in bankruptcy does not halt the application of special revenues to bond payments. However, the liens on special revenues are subordinated to the operating expenses of the system.
So how does this apply to Chester's Chapter 9 case?
Well, as part of its initial case filings, the city filed a lawsuit against bondholder Preston Hollow Community Capital, the indenture trustee U.S. Bank, and bond issuer Delaware County and the Delaware Valley Regional Finance Authority. The city seeks a declaratory judgment that the holders of the city's bonds don't have a perfected security interest in the revenue streams that secure the bonds, and that even if they did, they're not entitled to interest that accrues after the bankruptcy filing, which is also called the petition date. The city also seeks to avoid liens that secure the payment of the bonds, which would make the bondholders general unsecured creditors. Finally, the city seeks the turnover of approximately $2.9 million in funds held by U.S. Bank under a trust indenture that the city says exceeds the amount needed to pay bonds. The lawsuit relates to three sets of bonds. In 2009, Delaware County issued approximately $29 million in GO bonds to finance the building of Subaru Park, the soccer stadium. The city entered into a contribution agreement subsequently to that to pay a portion of the bond amount. The next year, in 2010, the city issued approximately $4 million in GO bonds to the finance authority and also entered into a loan agreement. In 2017, the city issued approximately $19 million, two series of guaranteed revenue bonds for which U.S. Bank serves as the indenture trustee. To secure the payment of those obligations, the city allegedly pledged certain waste incineration plant and casino revenues pursuant to a trust indenture and/or city ordinance. The city also issued letters directing the casino and incinerator owners and the Pennsylvania Department of Revenue to deposit revenues in certain bank accounts that were held by the bond trustee for the benefit of the pledgees. Delaware County and U.S. Bank filed UCC-1 financing statements to perfect their liens, but the finance authority did not. Perfecting liens means recording them to put third parties on notice of the liens. It has the effect of securing the priority of payment of secured obligations. Preston Hollow and U.S. Bank, which hold the 2017 bonds, as well as Delaware County and the Finance Authority, have all taken the position that the various pledges and financing statements perfected its security interests in the revenue streams, which gives them priority over the claims of unsecured creditors, including the pension claim holders. However, the city argues that notwithstanding the direction letters and the UCC-1 financing statements, the defendants don't have a security interest in the pledged revenues, let alone a perfected one. The city says that the revenues are not collateral of the type in which a creditor can obtain a security interest, and that the direction letters are insufficient to create a perfected security interest because they don't provide that the casino, waste treatment authority, and state government hold the collateral for the benefits of the bondholders. And since the liens are not perfected, says the city, security interests can be avoided. In the complaint, the city also asserts that even if the defendants possess perfected security interests, the revenue streams at issue are not special revenues, and the liens don't attach to property acquired by the debtor after the bankruptcy case. The resolution of this issue is significant because if the city succeeds in arguing the bonds aren't secured and in avoiding the bondholders' liens, then Preston Hollow and Delaware County would only be left with general secured unsecured claims that are on a par with other unsecured creditors like the pension holders and trade vendors. There has been some movement in the litigation. The city has entered into a consent order that provides for payments by U.S. Bank of $1 million to the city and $2 million to Preston Hollow, Delaware County, and the Finance Authority to be applied to accrued and unpaid interest through December 31st and the balance to the principal due under the relevant agreements. In addition, the city has settled with the Finance Authority, which had argued in a motion to dismiss that the pledged gaming revenues, which were to fund the city's partial sponsorship of Delaware County Community College, were statutorily prescribed for repayment to the Finance Authority and thus weren't the city's property in the first place.
So, Paul, it looks like the city has a lot of obligations and not a lot of money to pay for these obligations. Are they exploring anything like monetizing enterprise systems or something like that to help bring in more revenue?
Yes. One partial solution that the city has been exploring, which predates the Chapter 9 filing, is the monetization of its water, sewage, and parking systems. However, these attempts have been bogged down in litigation. In addition, the city's noted that selling the systems would provide only one-time cash infusions, and they wouldn't solve the city's legacy liabilities, particularly the pension and other retiree benefits.
So you can provide a little bit more background on the attempts to monetize the water system?
The Chester Water Authority, which was originally formed in 1939 to provide water services to the city residents, now also serves residents outside of the city in both Delaware and Chester counties. The CWA has nine directors, with three appointed by each of the city, Delaware County, and Chester County. In 2017, the CWA rejected a $320 million offer from Aqua Pennsylvania, a subsidiary of Essential Utilities, to purchase the water system. The city then told the CWA that it had the authority pursuant to the Pennsylvania Municipality Authorities Act, or MMA, to repossess the water system and to dissolve the CWA. The CWA responded by making a $60 million offer to the city to transfer the water assets into a 40-year trust, but the city declined. In March of 2019, the CWA filed a petition in the Delaware County Court of Common Pleas to transfer the CWA assets into a 40-year trust. The city opposed the action and sought proposals from buyers to purchase the water assets and received a top bid of $410 million from Aqua. In June 2019, the CWA filed a complaint to prevent the city from pursuing any sales. The city, in turn, sought a declaratory judgment that it could repossess and sell the water assets. In 2020, the Court of Common Pleas held that the city couldn't repossess and sell the water assets without the approval of Delaware and Chester counties. However, on appeal, the Commonwealth Court reversed and held that the city could reclaim and sell the water system. That litigation is currently on appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and it's been stayed by the city's bankruptcy filing. To date, the receiver has firmly maintained that any sale of the water assets requires his approval, which he hasn't given. He's also said that monetization does not necessarily mean privatization. This relates to concerns about the potential effect on rates of sale of the water system to a private entity. The city is also in litigation with the Delaware County Regional Water Quality Control Authority, or DELCORA. The city sold its sewage assets to DELCORA in 1973, but retained reversionary rights in the event of a subsequent sale. Later, the parties entered into an easement agreement that entitles the city to receive 10% of the proceeds of a subsequent sale of the same assets to a third party. In 2019, DELCORA entered into a $276 million asset purchase agreement with Aqua Pennsylvania Wastewater, but the city didn't consent to the sale, and it later filed a lawsuit seeking a declaratory judgment that the sewage assets will revert to the city unless it receives compensation. And finally, the city also seeks to monetize its parking system. In 2018, it entered into a contract with PFS 7 LLC to install parking meters throughout the city and to provide it with a 10-year revenue stream, after which the meters would revert back to the city. However, the city says the contract is under market and that it intends to reject it in bankruptcy. PFS, on the other hand, has said that the city owes it $12 million under the agreement.
You know, Paul, and listen to all the things that you're going over, it just strikes me, that saying about the death of 1,000 paper cuts. It just seems like it's just one thing after the other continues to compound the situation. With that said, is there anything else happening in the case that's interesting or things that we should be looking out for?
There were two other notable events in the early stages of the case, one of which has continuing ramifications. First, in December 2022, the debtors filed a motion to obtain another $5 million tax revenue anticipation note, or TRAN loan, from the DCED. In its motion to approve the loan, the city noted that it's used TRAN financing during the last few years to meet its general fund obligations, including payroll and vendor payments, before the biannual property taxes are collected. At the time, the city warned that it would run out of cash as early as mid-January of this year if the loan were not approved, and the bankruptcy court unsurprisingly approved the loan.
What was the other notable event?
The other event was a fight at the beginning of the case over whether the city was actually even eligible to file for bankruptcy. The fight was with the receiver and the city's mayor and city council, who argued that the Chapter 9 filing was invalid without their approval, and also with bondholder Preston Hollow, which had argued that the city hadn't attempted to negotiate in good faith with it prior to the bankruptcy filing.
Now, wouldn't the city's elected officials need to approve a bankruptcy filing for it to be valid?
Not necessarily. One condition for the filing of a municipal bankruptcy is that the municipality be specifically authorized under state law to file for Chapter 9. The state law requirements could require the approval of elected officials or, in Pennsylvania's case, a receiver properly appointed under state law. The requirement of state authorization stems from the fact that states are sovereign entities and municipalities are instruments of the state, so the state has to choose and can't be pushed into bankruptcy. The other requirements that a municipality must satisfy for a filing are that the municipality be insolvent, and this is interesting because it's different than companies in Chapter 11, because they actually do not have to be insolvent to file for bankruptcy. Another requirement is that the city desire to effect a plan of adjustment, and finally, that prior to the bankruptcy filing, the city have at least attempted to negotiate with creditors in good faith or found that negotiations were not practical.
Your last explanation, you used the word specifically. So I'm going to ask you specifically, what is the elected official's argument against the bankruptcy filing?
As I noted, Chester's mayor and the city council argued that the bankruptcy wasn't properly authorized under state law, even though a duly appointed receiver had sought and obtained approval for the filing under procedures that were mandated by state law. But interestingly enough, the elected officials didn't argue that the city was not specifically authorized to file the petition. Instead, they focused on the city desire to effect a plan of adjustment requirement for filing bankruptcy.
So, Paul, I'm glad you're here because I need your legal expertise. How could the officials argue not to object that the filing was not authorized, but at the same time that the city didn't desire to implement a plan to adjust its debts.
The elected officials argue that the state constitution and Pennsylvania's home law rule required that, notwithstanding the receiver's authorization, the city council must, at a minimum, adopt a resolution approving a bankruptcy filing to show that the city desires to effect a plan to adjust its debts. The official said that the fundamental right to decide whether a municipality can file for bankruptcy rests with the city alone, and the receiver's authorization, without the city council's blessing, was insufficient.
And why did Preston Hollow argue that the city hadn't negotiated in good faith?
Preston Hollow argued that the city didn't negotiate in good faith because it hadn't engaged in any quote-unquote meaningful discussions or made any proposal other than to say that Preston Hollow would receive nothing on its claim. The city countered that it negotiated to the best of its ability and had explained that the bonds are unsecured, with which Preston Hollow disagreed. And that goes back to the complaint that I was discussing earlier, in which the city is trying to avoid the liens that secure the bonds, which would end up, if that were successful, it would render Preston Hollow as an unsecured creditor.
So is there any way to evaluate Judge Ashley Chan's claim that Preston Hollow was intransigent?
I think that you could look to Judge Chan's statement that Preston Hollow's position had been virtually unchanged from 2020 to the bankruptcy filing. Also, you could look to the impasse between the city, which was arguing that the bond claims are unsecured, and Preston Hollow, which took the opposite position. In a decision issued in March, Bankruptcy Judge Chan ruled against both the city officials and Preston Hollow. She found that the city had satisfied the conditions for Chapter 9 relief and that the receiver had duly authorized the bankruptcy filing pursuant to the Act 47 procedures. She also found that the elected officials did not have standing to object to the city's bankruptcy filing because they didn't have a personal stake in the outcome and they weren't themselves creditors. Judge Chan also turned Preston Hollow's argument on its head, concluded that it wasn't the city, but Preston Hollow that had been a stone wall during the negotiations and impossible to negotiate with. That eligibility decision is currently on appeal to the district court.
It's my impression that this fight between the receiver and the elected officials creates some challenges with the city's bankruptcy case. Am I right?
Yes, you're definitely right, Paul. It's important to note that the fight between the elected officials and the receiver has been a power struggle that well predates the bankruptcy filing and dates almost back to Dowiri's appointment as receiver. Before the filing, Dowiri, claiming that the city officials refused to follow his directives, obtained a mandamus order from the Commonwealth Court, requiring city employees to share financial information and to comply with an interim chief financial officer's policies and programs and financial controls. That wasn't enough, and the receiver filed another motion to modify his recovery plan to clarify the city's chain of command and to suspend the elected officials' administrative duties. The Commonwealth judge granted in part the receiver's requested relief, and the elected officials have appealed the order to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Importantly, in April, the receiver said that the litigation brought by the elected officials was impeding the city's recovery efforts, and he warned that he might have to disincorporate the city by the end of the year. If that were to happen, the city would become an unincorporated service district, the city's elected officials would be dismissed, the city's employees fired, and a state administrator would manage the city.
So, Paul, you've covered a lot of ground here in terms of looking back and getting us up to speed on the bankruptcy filing and the issues. Can you give us some sense, a preview of what we can expect in the case?
Well, during the first few months of the case, the city has been laying the groundwork for an attempt to reach a consensual resolution of its thorniest debt issues. And in doing so, it's used more sticks than carrots. The receiver's warning that the city may dissolve before the end of the year puts pressure on the various constituencies to sit down at the mediation table and work out a compromise, particularly the elected officials, but also the representatives of the pension holders and the various unions. In addition, it will be important to see how the receiver's action against the bondholders proceeds. If he's successful in reducing their claims to general unsecured claims, there'll be more money for other general unsecured creditors, including pensioners. However, the amount of newly available money would still be small relative to the outstanding pension and OPEB obligations, so the pensioners would still most likely face large cuts. It will also be interesting to see how the city renegotiates its collective bargaining agreements with its three unions. The big stick there is the city's power to reject the agreements, which means that the pensioners would only have claims in pro rata bankruptcy dollars and not whole dollars. We should also look out for progress in the city's litigations over its water, sewing, and parking systems, and any new proposals to monetize them. And finally, there's the eligibility appeal. If the city officials succeed in reversing the bankruptcy court, then the whole bankruptcy case can get thrown out, which upends everything.
Well, these cases are always, in terms of the Chapter 9 cases, are always interesting because they're rare, and the opportunity for case precedent certainly gets a lot of people's attention, and we'll definitely be following this over the months to come. But thank you, Paul and Greg, for your contributions to this week's podcast. To our audience, I hope you found this episode informative. Thank you for listening to the Muni Lowdown. Please support us by liking, sharing, and/or subscribing to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Join us every Thursday for the latest drop of the Muni Lowdown. Take care.